I'm here with Dr. Natalie Dietrich-Jones, who is a research fellow at the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica. Thank you for agreeing to this interview today.
You're welcome, and it's nice to meet you. Virtually, we should have met face-to-face, but I guess it's working out as it should have.
Yes, just to say that we were supposed to meet during our trip to Kingston, but Natalie was very busy, so yeah, she's agreed to a Zoom call today. So thank you so much. Firstly, could you talk to me a little bit about your research? Because I know that you have a background in researching migration issues, and I'm just very interested in learning more about your work.
Okay, so I do research on the governance of migration, border politics and geographies, and on vulnerable migrants. Normally, my research focuses on intra-regional migration within the Caribbean, especially the Caribbean community, single market and economy. So my PhD research had looked at undocumented intra-regional migration to Barbados. And now one of my main projects is on Venezuelan migration to the Southern Caribbean, so Aruba, Curacao, Guyana, and Trinidad and Tobago. But I also have an interest in the issue of Windrush, which is why we're here today. More so scholar activism than research, direct research, but I have done a few small projects related to Windrush since the scandal first emerged. And so we can talk more about that.
When did you first hear about the scandal?
So an interesting fact is it impacted me before I heard about it. I was studying in the UK between 2009 and, say, 2012. And I went to a clinic near to where I was living in London at the time. I studied in Manchester, but for a while I was living in London. And I normally go to the clinic without any issues. And this time I went to the clinic and they were like, you need to bring your passport. We can't see you unless you have your passport on you. And I'm like, but why this? And I've never been asked this before. Anyway, I went and retrieved the passport. Of course, they flipped to the page with my student visa to check if I'm there lawfully.
Sorry, just to confirm, your Jamaican passport,
right? My Jamaican passport. I'm a Jamaican to study in the UK. I would have needed a student visa. The student visa allows me a maximum of 40 hours of work and then access to services like healthcare, and I think it says that on the visa. So they flipped to the visa page. I didn't think anything of it, and it's obviously years later when the scandal erupts that I'm like connecting the dots and realize that they were trying to check if I was lawfully resident in the UK and thus eligible for access to health services. So the scandal, I think for us, came full force maybe like 2016 thereabout. Things would have accelerated since then. So I did an exhibition in 2018. I traveled to Warwick for an event in 2019.
Can you remember what the event was? What was it for? Was it for your research or
just for so hearing more and more about Windrush, of course we're getting concerned in the region, and we are seeing the stories mostly in the Guardian, but like things that come up on BBC and then maybe the local media might carry this a story of one of the persons who would have been deported and unable to return.
Where would you have seen news reports then in the local press?
Yes. So there were a few newspaper articles. The one I remember the most is of a boxer who was not able to. It's an elderly gentleman who in his heyday was a boxer, a very prolific boxer, and then he's deported to Jamaica and unable to return. So we started seeing a few of these stories in the press about persons who were returned. Mm. unlawfully. And then are trying to get the High Commission here, the British High Commission, to assist with their return.
And the British High Commission in Kingston, yeah. And can I ask then, when you first had this experience and this exchange with at a healthcare clinic, what was your initial reaction? Was it something that you thought? Did you find it strange, or was it of shock or confusion? Or
it would have been confusion. It wasn't the first time I was studying in the UK. I would have used health centres before. I've never been asked to produce my passport. Maybe they may ask for my student ID, but even that I don't remember having to show my student ID. I was like, I kept asking, why do I need to produce the document? And they were saying I would not be able to be seen unless, so they didn't explain why, they just said I needed to show the passport in order for the doctor to see me.
This was an experience then, because before you weren't asked for this documentation, is that correct?
No, I've never been asked. So as far as I recall, the hostile environment policy was introduced in 2010. I was there from 2009. This would have happened in 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. It's only in retrospect and reflecting, because after the event, I kind of put it in the back of my mind. I was like, okay, I'm assuming they want to check that I have access to the health center and that I'm not undocumented, because that's my area of research. So I kind of understand why they're asking me for it. But having not been asked before, the whole experience was just kind of strange. So it was in the back of my head, and it wasn't until I started hearing about the experiences of the Windrush victims who were asked to, you know, prove their status in the UK that it started to make sense what had happened to me. Mm.
And how would you say that your knowledge of the Windrush scandal, how does that relate or compare to the research that that told me about at the beginning of the interview, so about island migration within the Caribbean?
So there are parallels in the sense of, if you're undocumented, the state, you're very vulnerable, and the state can use different means to exclude you from society. So that's what my research mainly focused on, exclusion. And exclusion from the labor market, exclusion from healthcare and other social services like education. And then they can also deport you once they find you and detain you. So there are those parallels. The difference is that the persons who were affected by Windrush would have been mostly elderly persons who would have traveled to the UK in the post-Second World War period, and who basically have lived their entire adult lives in the UK, supporting the development of critical services like the NHS, like the transport services, and thinking, because they had in their passports leave to remain, that they were lawfully in the UK. I'll come back to that in a second. That they're lawfully in the UK. With the migrants that I typically work with, they travel to destinations in the Caribbean, and they have, based on the regulations of our treaty, they have up to 6 months to stay. If they wish to work, they would have to get a work permit, or they would need to prove that they fall within one of the 10 categories of skilled nationals, and they would need to get that skill accredited before they can work. So when I lived in Barbados, for example, I got a skill certificate saying I can live and work in Barbados, and then I got a stamp in my passport. The time periods are different. The reasons people fall into undocumentedness are different. And then also, I would say, the response of the UK government, because coming to what I said earlier, there was documentation proving that these individuals had the right to remain in the UK, and those documentation had been destroyed, and no administration has accepted responsibility for that. They've all said it was the other person that, like, whoever, we burned it, but you approved that it be burned or something, whatever the reasons were. So their right to remain, there is no evidence of that. And with the individuals in the Caribbean, it is a little bit more clear whether you're documented or undocumented.
I would actually argue that there's one fundamental difference between the groups of people that you're researching in the Caribbean and people affected by the Windrush scandal, which is that those affected by the Windrush scandal were British citizens, right? They were recognised by the British state as not being migrants, but in fact being, British. And I think I think that's a fundamental aspect of this issue that is somehow or oftentimes wrapped up within kind of an immigration discourse.
Right. So they were invited often by recruitment agencies to work in the UK, having come from colonies in the Caribbean that were governed by the British. They would have been British citizens, so they would have landed in the UK as citizens. So that documentation that I referred to earlier, they would have had UK passports. It would have said something like colony of Britain or whatever, but they would have had a UK passport, and they would have been given the right to remain on the basis that they were British citizens. There's an asterisk beside that, though, based on the conversations that I've had, which is that there was, even before the hostile environment policy, I believe, rumblings about the citizenship claims of persons of Caribbean/African/Indian descent. So
yeah, and what do you know about that history? Has that fed into your research at all?
So what I know is that this is based on a discussion with an academic who, I would need her permission to pass on her detail, but what she has shared is based on her experience as a former diplomat, that they had heard these rumblings. They were encouraging Caribbean nationals to go and get, documentation, like a passport or something, because even though they were UK nationals, a lot of them never held a UK passport. And some of them may have held Jamaican passports. And so for the ones, some persons travel to Jamaica or Barbados on the Jamaican passport, and it's when they're going to return that the issues come up about them not being
And UK where do these issues arise?
At the airport.
And who are the decision makers then making that decision to block people from taking the plane?
So this is one of the areas that I... So this is one of the parallels, again, in terms of the research areas. Board of officials, whether it's immigration officials and... So persons working at the airport or persons in the offices who make decisions, they are the ones who have a lot of control. So they're not policymakers, they enforce the policy. And between immigration officials, but also even airline employees, someone will come because their first port of call is going to be at the desk to check in, right? Mm-hmm. This is before they get through to security and so on. They arrive at the airport, they go to the desk, and it's an airline employee who looks at their passport and makes a determination that they are not eligible to return on the basis of their passport and whatever documentation that they have. So this I find a little bit problematic, but it's just how the system is structured. And in the case of the Windrush generation, because they did not have a UK passport or a passport that says indefinitely to remain, that is where a lot of the issues arose for those who traveled on their own and then weren't able to to return.
But you've already mentioned a number of different people then that are intervening beyond the state, right, to effectively police immigration control. So we've already mentioned about a person, the receptionist at the health clinic, people who work for the airline, airport employees. Who else would you say who are beyond the state, really, but are still serving that function of...
So reading the stories of the Windrush victims, the persons affected by the hostile environment policy, landlords could make a determination. So you would be renting a place and then all of a sudden, oh, you can't stay here anymore unless you can prove that you have right to remain. Your employer, who you've been paying NIS and everything else before, they were paying you a salary, and now all of a sudden, oh, we need to check that you have indefinite leave to remain. And if you can't, you can't be employed. I mean, there was a story about a woman who was a chef at the Houses of Parliament. Like, how can somebody that's been working at the Houses of Parliament for however many years now all of a sudden fall into undocumentedness? Like, that just does.
But in addition to that, indefinite leave to remain is a status given to migrants. It's not a status given to people who were recognised by the British state as being citizens. So again, yeah, but it's a difficult scenario, because you've got this tension over people who, for all rights and purposes, believe or see themselves as being either living in the UK, I'm not a great fan of the word legitimately, but having the right to live in the UK, and then people who are finding that the system itself is working against them effectively, because, as you say, these are people who didn't necessarily need a passport or travel, but changes to the system meant that they were increasingly finding demands placed upon them to provide evidence of who they were.
Right, and those changes, so there, I find the UK citizenship regulations to be a little bit complicated and slightly racialized if you look at the impact on Afro-Caribbean migrants in particular, because there have been a lot of changes to legislation that impact that population in particular. And there is another dimension of changes in policy that's not discussed as significantly as Windrush, which relates to, so they changed the rules. I can't remember which regulation it is, but they're for persons who are born in overseas territories whose fathers basically held claim to UK citizenship, they would be able to pass on that citizenship to their children. They had made a couple changes, one of which is that I think the parents had to be married for the father to pass on citizenship. And then there was another change, and that has affected persons born in overseas territories who might otherwise have claims to UK citizenship no longer being able to claim that citizenship. That was a more recent change. I would have to send that one to you via email, because I'm not remembering off the top of my head which legislation.
No, well, what we're building with this project is a very complex picture of citizenship reform and immigration reform since the 1960s and before, really. But and this is certainly not something that that other scholars haven't been highlighting for many decades, but the intention to keep Britain white, to use a workforce that would help build the UK after the Second World War, that would help revitalise the economy and work in essential services. But behind the paradox of that is the underlining desire, basically, of the British government and British politicians to keep Britain white. I'm really interested. You told me then that you that you became a bit more actively involved then in the Windrush scandal during your time in the UK. How did that come about?
So I did a few things because I did want to do a project on digital activism and the Windrush scandal. So it's still there in my background and I will hopefully get to it at some point. So I had a trip to the UK and I had tried to arrange some interviews with persons who were impacted by Windrush or involved in advocacy in some way. And I did get a few of those interviews.
Who specifically were the people, if that's okay to disclose, who were the people that you spoke to as part of that?
I think
project?
I can disclose one but not the other.
That's okay.
So, so I spoke with Amelia Gentleman. I had been in contact with Patrick Vernon over email, and I had a very interesting experience, which I mentioned just before we started, where I had wanted to meet with him in person, and he was like, well, today's not the best day because we're going to do this march on the Home Office, but if you want to come, you can come. And I had no idea where I was going. I think I may have passed the Home Office once.
Okay.
Before,
and just quickly, could you just explain to people who Amelia Gentleman is and who Patrick Vernon is, and what their role has been within this kind of around the scandal?
Amelia Gentleman is a Guardian journalist who basically broke the Windrush scandal. A lot of the stories that she wrote highlighted the challenges that persons were experiencing and basically put a magnifying glass on this issue. And then Patrick Vernon is a Jamaican descended person whose parents would have traveled to the UK. And so he's British and very much involved in the advocacy around victims' rights and so on. So I had wanted to meet with Mr. Vernon. He's actually done a lot of work on Windrush. I believe he was involved as a curator for a Windrush gallery or something. And so that's how I had come onto his name, because I was interested in doing an exhibition, and when I was searching, I found his name.
And what year was this? What year did you?
This was 2019 when I travelled.
And did you manage to meet with both Amelia Gentleman and Patrick Vernon?
Right. So I spoke with Miss Gentleman. I visited the Guardian, and we had a conversation. And then I couldn't meet with Mr. Vernon in the way that I wanted, but he invited me to attend this protest, and I was like, okay, a little bit nervous because I wasn't sure how police were going to be responding to this, but I turned up at the Home Office. It was a very tense but peaceful protest, if you will.
What year was this? Can you remember?
This is 2019. They were gathered in front of the Home Office with some placards, persons, I think they may have had a few of their adult children, but it was mostly victims affected by the hostile environment policy. They were there, the media was there, so they spoke to the media. We may have been carried on Sky News, I believe Sky News was there. So it went on TV, and then we marched from the Home Office to Downing Street, and we had a small protest outside of Downing Street as well. And then after we left Downing Street, we went up home and we had a meal. And it was really interesting because these are normal people who want to live their lives and feel like restrict and also valued for what they've done. And even though they were upset, they were still able to, come together and enjoy this.
What was the main topic of conversation? I mean, were these people who had been directly affected by the scandal itself? Were they people who had family and friends who had been affected? Or were there also people who had just, heard about the impact of the scandal and wanted to protest?
So there was a politician there from one of the boroughs in the UK. There was a well-known, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to.
That's fine.
There was a well-known person there. He would not be affected directly, but he would certainly know people. He has gotten an award and so on for his activism in his specific area of work. And then there were the victims of, so I think I can say her name because she's been in the press a lot. So like Glenda, I'm trying to remember Glenda's last name. She was there, and then there were a few others there. And so as I said, the conversation was a mixture of what was going to happen next in terms of next steps, in terms of activism and so on. But then it was just also, they were having a meal and they were talking, they're friends, you could see, they know each other. They just want to be supporting each other.
And was it possibly Glenda Caesar, possibly?
Yes, Glenda Caesar. Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. And what came of that event then for you? What did you take away from being involved in not just the research side, but also having those conversations with people who were so closely linked to or affected by these policies?
So I'm hoping I'm reflecting it the way that they saw it, but I was a little bit, so I was excited to be there. It's my first time in any kind of protest ever. And seeing that protest of that nature is necessary in order to the outcomes that you would want. So outcomes in this sense would mean they're now having conversations around compensation for persons who've been affected by Windrush, because there was a compensation scheme designed by the government in order to get persons. So they were talking about how long it's been taking for claims to be processed and all the type of information that is being requested, and why would they need all of this, because they have all this information already, and why is it taking so long? And then like a frustration and almost a fear, because if I'm remembering correctly, persons were concerned that they would pass before, you know, they would be getting their claims, because they knew of persons who were quite elderly, you know, who were waiting on their claims. They had lost their job. Persons had been put out of their flats. And so kind of a fear that they wouldn't necessarily be getting any claims settled before, you know, they really needed it.
And you mentioned, and of course you don't have to, please don't feel like you have to name names, but you mentioned that you spoke to a diplomat who said that they had rumblings of, you know, that this happening. Do you remember what time frame that was?
I think that might have been in the 90s, but I don't want to say, like, definitively. But it was certainly before the hostile environment policy was put into.
Yeah, did you talk about the role of the High Commission at all? So, for example, the Jamaican High Commission, and what their, were they present at the protests? What kind of impression did people have of their involvement?
So I've spoken to the High Commission. I'm trying to remember if it was on the same trip, because I spoke to them before I got to the UK, and then after I arrived in the UK in 2019, I visited the High Commission again and met with High Commissioner Ramakan.
Okay, Ramakan, yeah, I just met him.
So I met with High Commissioner Ramakan, and we, you know, with that visit in the UK was a little bit different from before, because the first interaction was for an interview related to the prison deal that the UK had proposed to Jamaica. And so there was overlap in that discussion about reparations and Windrush, and how everything tied together in terms of the UK's policy approach to Jamaica.
Could you elaborate a little bit more about that?
The UK Prime Minister I think it would have been Blair at the
time. I think it was David Cameron, if I'm not mistaken.
Cameron. David Cameron.
Yeah.
Jamaica circa, 2005, 2006, I think. And one of the elements of the development approach that the UK proposed for Jamaica was to build a prison that would house returned Jamaican nationals from the UK. And it was met with a lot of skepticism in Jamaica because we felt that the intervention was only because the UK wanted to return these individuals. There would have been individuals convicted mostly for drug offenses, but maybe other types of violent crime. And we thought that it was unfair to us to make a proposal that hinged on the return of these individuals. There was a lot of discussion about the cost-benefit analysis, if you will, about whether the prison would work, and in the end, the deal was rejected. There was a change in administration. When Cameron came, it was one administration, and then shortly after, there was an election, and the administration that came in said it was not financially feasible. That was one of the reasons they put forward to accept the deal, because even though the UK said they would finance the prison, it was a part financing, and Jamaica did not have the funds in to develop the prison. But there's a lot of backstory to this. I don't know if you know.
So that was just for a bit of clarity, that was around the time of Portia Simpson Miller, is that correct? And then she was replaced by Bruce Golding.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I'm not sure if I've got the timeline correct there, so I will have...
Is it 2005 that you're seeing, or
2006?
2006. Right. Mm-hmm. So I was saying that our main prison in the in Jamaica, that's in Kingston, was built by the British. There are some persons who suggest that it was built to house runaway slaves.
So what year are we talking? We're talking centuries.
This is 19th century, maybe. Late 19th century, if I'm remembering the dates correctly. So they would have built this prison. There's a lot of complex things.
Of course, but clearly I think that the thing to take away is that there's obviously a strong colonial trauma there that's been left by the Brits, and the criminalisation of Jamaicans, the building of prisons, the treating of people, from enslaved persons all the way until modern day. The British government in that, and British diplomatic representatives have been very much a part of that. So I think the suggestion or the proposal to build a prison carries with that a lot of historical baggage and controversy, specifically because of what that represents for people.
Exactly. And so persons were saying, don't give us a prison, give us reparations, give us schools, don't give us a prison, give us things that will actually assist with our development as a small island developing state.
So people like Vereen Shepherd and people like Hilary Beckles, of course.
Right.
Well, specifically Vereen, I would say, she's been very clear about the close connection between, for example, the Windrush scandal itself and the reparations debate, specifically because it's another example of harm, intentional harm upon a group of people, specifically people of colour.
Right, which is what I was just going to say, because when it came back to Windrush, one of the main things that the high commissioners and other diplomats would have demanded was an apology for Windrush, And I would dare say an apology for slavery, because one of the points of the there's a 10-point reparation plan. I don't know if Professor Shepherd would have mentioned this. And one of the points in the plan is an apology for what the British have done in terms of the trauma that you mentioned to the region. So when Windrush came up, this was kind of like another slap in the face. And it's like, okay, you need to do something about this. And you need to apologize to our people for the harm that you've done. And so a lot of the advocacy at the time by the diplomats concentrated on this apology. And initially Theresa May had said she wouldn't apologize, but then eventually she had to apologize, and then steps were taken.
Yeah, it led to the resignation of Amber Rudd as well, because because of her direct involvement in the scandal. I'm really interested in the reaction of people in Jamaica and in the broader Caribbean to the scandal. Was it? I know you said that there were newspaper reports. I think you were quoting the reports that I've seen as well, that which came out in the Gleaner. What was the general feeling at that time when the scandal erupted? But also the maybe informal conversations that people have had around the scandal. Does it resonate with everyday Jamaicans? Is it something that they would immediately think of when they talk about the UK?
So I'll give a personal story and then I will circle back a bit to the question. So around the time that all of this is happening, so I have mixed feelings about this in terms of reparations. I have benefited from a scholarship from the UK government when I did my master's, and there is a UK journalist / writer who came to Jamaica to meet with young Jamaicans and to talk about reparations. He published his book, I think it was early this year or sometime last year. His name is escaping me now, but one of the things that I had mentioned is that talking about reparations is complicated for me, because I've benefited from the scholarship, and a lot of Jamaicans continue to benefit from things like Shevening, from Commonwealth Scholarship, and so on. But around the time that all of this is happening, I'm invited by the Cambridge Commonwealth Society to attend a function at the High Commission, and I had a lot of mixed feelings about going, and initially I said I would go. It's in the Windrush Garden. I would go to the Windrush Garden and wear puff t-shirts to protest this thing. So I ended up not going to the event, but they did have, there's a thing that they have every year where they celebrate the presence of the UK in Jamaica, and I did go to that. And
where was that? Sorry, the High Commission? The British High Commission.
And so I did get an opportunity just to look at the gardens and so on.
High Commissioner's residence,
it's on the grounds of the High Commission. You know, I'm not sure if the High Commission resides there, but it's always interesting when I go there, the type of feelings that come into my brain, because you know what the historical legacy is.
Yeah, and if you describe to the people who are listening what you can see visibly, it's green grass everywhere and huge colonial architecture.
Right, so the colonial architecture, I wouldn't say opulence, but there is a very significant divide between what is on that premises and then what is immediately outside the gate. And even getting into the High Commission is always a little bit dramatic, because they have barriers that can go up and down. The barriers have to go all the way down for you to drive over them. Then there is another gate. The gate has to open. Mm-hmm. So it's like very protected from the society that it says it's there to serve. At one point, you used to be able to go to the High Commission to process your visa. That doesn't happen anymore. It's been outsourced to some external companies. I think now it's the IOM that manages it on their behalf. Before, it was a private company. So really, the Jamaican population doesn't visit the High Commission.
Yeah, and this has happened. This has happened across Latin America and the Caribbean. So there was a clear decision by the British government to outsource documents, and it is would argue it's a huge statement, because, as you say, when you to enter the High Commission, it's kind of like a fortress, right? You have to go through advanced security checks, you have to go through multiple kind of guards and gates and all sorts of things. And similarly, that's what the the changes to closing down that kind of personal interaction, that opportunity for people to speak to a British representative and explain that, you know, if they're having problems getting a visa, or if they're trying to sort out citizenship issues, or if they have a question, that's gone. That was removed. And what do you think? I mean, that was strategic. Do you think that was something that was part of this broader hostile environment policy?
I'm not sure who motivated it, but it certainly distinguishes the British High Commission from the other embassies and consulates.
In what way? I think that's really important, I think, to understand that.
Well, the U.S. would probably be the exception, but the U.S. manages theirs a little bit differently. But you still go to the German embassy, you still go to the Belgian embassy, the French embassy, you go directly for an interview and to drop your documents off. You can't do that with the British High Commission. And it's interesting, those countries, we do have a relationship with them, but in terms of the fact that Britain is our mother country, we were colonized by them, but we can't have ready access to the High Commission. I think that does say a lot. But just to circle back, I think the question you were asking was what was the mood of the other territories. So I think there was indignation across the region, but just something to point out that even though we have Caribbean nationals from all countries living in the UK, that it would be certain pockets that would probably be more affected than others. So you mentioned St. Kitts, the Barbados, Jamaica, Trinidad.
I mean, one example Jamaica's a glaring example of where people were overwhelmingly affected. Whereas when you look, I interviewed the former High Commissioner to Belize, and it didn't even resonate there, right? It's maybe one case, if any. So there's definitely huge differences from island to island in terms of who was impacted.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so even though I would say collectively as a region that was colonized by the British, and there's Belize is an interesting case in that history, but so as a region that was colonized by the British, collective indignation, but more indignant in the countries that would have had nationals that were like directly affected. So as I said, Jamaica and Barbados and so on.
And I remember, I think, looking through the archives of, I think it was called the Caribbean Advisory Board, which was which was set up, I think, during the Blair government, and it was to talk, headed up by Baroness Scotland, if I remember correctly. And the agenda items on there did not mention questions over citizenship and immigration. I don't know if that was an oversight or just simply that it wasn't something that was being talked about in diplomatic circles or in certain government circles. But that what's interesting when you mentioned the Chevening Scholarship was that there was an emphasis on this idea of cultural exchange, of ensuring that people study in the UK. So there's clearly, I think, a focus on a type of immigration, right, or a type of person that the UK was aiming to welcome in the UK, and other people who essentially in the past were told that they were welcome found out very quickly that once they'd served a purpose, that they weren't welcome and were faced very difficult kind of lived reality. So back to back to that time then, around when you were you'd been on that protest and you spoke with Amelia Gentleman and Patrick Vernon. Did you attend anything else, or were you part of any other kind of activities around the scandal at that time? I think you mentioned to me, something about your conference visits and your time as when you were a researcher. I just wondered what other activities you were partaking in.
As I mentioned, I'm interested in digital activism around Windrush. So I follow a lot of the campaigners on Twitter and just try to keep track of what's happening and so on. But I was able to attend an event that was held for persons who were trying to get their claims sorted. So one of those institutions had a clinic.
That was just to be clear, was that a Jamaican organization that organized
the event? No, these are all based in the UK.
Were they organized by a group of, community group or a group of people, or was it something that was more formal, i.e. organized by the Jamaican High Commission or by...
A community-led NGO.
Okay.
And what they did was they had a representative from the Home Office basically do like a Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have questions about how to submit your application, if there's a delay and so on. And it was interesting how the representative can handle the questions that were being posed, because they're trying to be, I guess, unbiased and present what I guess is a standard, okay, this is what you need to do. Mm-hmm. But persons had like, I submitted my thing and can you tell me? And they couldn't give, obviously, like direct one-on-one advice to people. It was more of a generic, okay, this is what the Home Office does kind of thing. But I still think it was helpful for those who attended. They've had others since then, and they're not the only NGO organizing things like this. You will see online persons organizing benefits. Actually, something popped up on my phone recently. I think they're having some kind of concert. Someone is organizing a drive. So there are different organizations doing different kinds of things. I thought by this time persons would have been compensated and, you know, moving on with their lives. It's 2022 and some people still haven't gotten their claims. Some persons have died, and the question is, okay, does the family have any legal claim to that benefit that was supposed to be, sorry, the settlement that was supposed to be awarded by the government? So we haven't really had closure to that event 3 to 4 years since, longer than that. the media has been writing about Windrush.
So I find it really interesting what you said about digital activism as well. So I know that, I think it was Patrick Vernon, right, that launched a petition right after the scandal, if I'm correct. I just wondered how closely you were following that kind of activism. So, and if you could tell me a little bit more about what you mean by digital activism and the role it played, particularly in this case.
Okay, you broke up a little bit just now, but I think you're asking me to explain the digital activism space. So how I understand it to be is NGOs using non-traditional media like social media, so Twitter. I don't follow anybody on Instagram, so I can't speak to Instagram. I mostly have the experience on Twitter. And using that medium to either flag abuses by the government, to point persons to resources that would be useful, or to highlight activities and events that are to fundraise or to build awareness and so on. One of the ways it's been actually very pivotal, I think, is with these deportation flights. So you will see individuals put up a post, oh, deportation flight scheduled for XXX. I know an individual who's supposed to be deported, but they have family living in the UK, their partner is ill, or they have children and they're trying to send them away. They live in the UK for 20 plus years, blah, 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 blah.
So how much of that then, what transnational aspect is there to that? Do you think that as those kind of strategies have helped a dialogue, basically, have helped join up people in the Caribbean with people affected? Do you think that's been a strategy or a tool that's been used?
So if, as an outsider looking in, the way that I see it is like shining a light on the abuses and possibly pointing persons to resources. So individuals have been able to get legal assistance through those networks. If they follow individuals or they know persons who follow, they'll be put in touch with support, different types of support system. And you will see them report, five persons have been removed from the flight due to our thing, and we're hoping that however many more, the flight will not leave at all because we, petitioned and we were able to get however many persons removed.
And it's not just actions that engage activists themselves to react, but also to provide people with or guide people towards legal resources. Part of the community who are supportive of trying to find a way out of or provide advice or help. And what do you know about legal aid?
Not that speak to that. I don't know a lot, but I have wanted to say something about a point I made earlier about the deportation flights. There is always a very interesting timing to when these things happen. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge visited Jamaica earlier this year, and they actually had seized deportation flights. They didn't have any flights before they came. I think they're supposed to have resumed now, but because they basically buy a private thing.
Yeah, charter of flights.
Charter flights. You don't always know when persons are coming unless you're involved on the ground with like Fury. Fury is the organization that responds to persons who have been involuntarily returned. So unless you're working with Fury and so on, you wouldn't know that persons are coming like on a fairly regular basis. But there's always politics or optics behind sometimes when the flights happen. So just before the Duke and Duchess came, they had stopped deportation flights. There was another political event. It's escaping me at the moment, but that was, again, they stopped.
What would you say would be the kind of links between activist groups then, or NGOs or kind of civil society organisations and their campaigns in Jamaica in particular with the UK? Do you think there is a tendency to do you think there's a disconnect there, basically, or do you think that there's been as you said, with the kind of the increase in digital activism and as you said as well, being an outsider looking in, which I think is a fascinating way to look at it, do you think has that led to kind of the changes in the way people might address advocacy or organise?
I think from the UK side, maybe not so much here, because I don't really see the same type of activism in the digital space with social media. You may see a few newspaper reports, you may see persons reported on TV or on the radio. The type or the scale of activism that I see online for UK-based organizations.
Mm.
I don't see for Jamaican, but that has to do with just the number of organizations that exist, the resources and so on. And it could also be that the links are there, but because I'm not involved, I'm not seeing it.
Okay, so as we come to the end of the interview, I wanted to ask you a question then about your research into the governance of migration and into inter-regional migration. And the question I have is asking about the future. Where do you see the future leading, particularly with regards to how migration is being governed, and particularly thinking of it from way beyond a Jamaican or just a UK perspective, but how these systems are affecting people around the world?
I see a bleak future. I hope I'm wrong. As a Caribbean national, we've been seeing progressively like the legal pathways to migration being eroded to the traditional destinations. So if you think about the U.S., obviously the U.K., which we just spoke at length about, maybe the exception would be Canada, but there's still an asterisk there because they're looking for, you mentioned the profile of the successful migrant, they're looking for a particular type of migrant. So the legal pathways to migration for Caribbean nationals are being constrained because there are more restrictive policies being introduced. You see that with increases in deportation, for example, you see that in maybe intermittent, if not sustained, erasure of certain things. So like when I was in the UK, for example, I didn't get the opportunity to stay for a year because the government at the time ended that. I think you can do it now. But when my husband was studying, he couldn't because, he had the chance, but nobody would hire a foreign national that you have to do a marketability assessment for and then get a visa for. So more restrictive measures, but this doesn't apply to just those, I would say, developed economies. Even in the region, we have restrictive policy mechanisms being introduced to contain, I don't like to use flow, but the flow of migrants. There was a lot of discussion about how countries should respond to the Venezuelan migration crisis. It was largely restrictive until the international agencies stepped in, and you kind of see a more receptive response, but by and large, Venezuelan migrants still can't work in the destinations that they travel to, and they have limited access to healthcare and education and so on.
And I think in terms of the Americas, I think the Venezuelan example is an excellent one to show, really how states focus on how their focus on different groups and different nationalities shifts depending on kind of economic need and regional crisis.
In our case with Haiti, because in 2018, Barbados had removed the visa requirement for Haitian nationals, and then within a year, they had reversed it and said, okay, they need visas. And so Haitians have been going all the way to Chile trying to make their way to the States because they're not wanted in this region, even though they're members of the single market and economy. It's a very politicized / racialized approach to dealing with unwanted migrants or undesirables, or Immigration Act still have lists of people labeled prohibited migrants, persons who are ill, who they label as imbeciles and with certain diseases and so on, based on what is in the law, should not have access to our state.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of the interview now. I just wanted to ask, is there anything else that you'd like to add or to talk about, just to conclude, really?
Well, just to say that UWE encourages scholar activism, and that takes place in different ways. And I have been using the migration development poster as a way to highlight the experiences of persons, vulnerable migrants, including windrush migrants. We did have a windrush exhibition pre-COVID that went really well that the museum, the UWI Museum, had mounted. So we are trying to use different ways, including research, but also public events and exhibits in order to showcase the experience of individuals impacted by restrictive migration policy. And I hope to be involved in future activities of that nature.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, you're welcome.